All right, welcome everybody. This is Bowman, Palestine, and DSA. How can DSA hold elected officials accountable? We'll have a panel with speakers today from the Tempest Collective and the Reform and Revolution Caucus of DSA. And we'll be talking about what happened with various things related to this issue. So there's first Jamal Bowman's yes vote to fund the Iron Dome, along with the response to that from DSA's rank and file and the decisions and handling of it from DSA's National Political Committee. But beyond that, we think there is a question of what we think should have been done in this particular instance, but also the event raised important questions that DSA needs to grapple with, like the difficulty of the situation itself, making it clear that we have yet to develop our ability to hold DSA electeds accountable to the movement that put them in office, and we need to chart a path toward that. Additionally, how should DSA and our elected left representatives relate to the struggle for Palestinian liberation? What is the best way to enact our international solidarity, et cetera? We'll get to all of that in just a minute here. First, I just want to introduce how this is going to work and our speakers and our caucus, which organized this. So this meeting was organized by Reform and Revolution, a Marxist caucus of DSA. We stand in the revolutionary tradition, socialist tradition that fights to end economic inequality, racism, sexism, and all forms of oppression. Our mission is to help build DSA into a powerful force to revitalize working class politics, strengthen labor and social movements, and to achieve a socialist future. So if you listen today and if you're interested in our politics, you can check out our magazine using the link that will be dropped in the chat in just a moment. And if you like what you see, just make sure you subscribe right away so you can get our next issue, which is going to be going to print next month. And then we have a panelist of speakers today. We have two speakers, one from the Tempest Collective and one from R&R. So Andrew Cernatinger is a labor activist and member of DSA in Madison, Wisconsin. He is a member of the Tempest Collective and has written for New Politics, International Viewpoint, and In These Times. And Brandon Madsen is a member of Portland DSA, American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE Local 2157, and DSA's Reform and Revolution Caucus. So we'll start by asking three important questions regarding the topic today and allow each panelist to answer for 5 minutes per panelist per question. After this, we'll move to a general discussion where everyone is welcome to participate. If you want to get on stack to speak during that, please send a direct message to my co-host, Brian. And each speaker will have up to 3 minutes to speak. We'll go for 25 minutes before bringing in the speakers again for another 5 minute contribution each. From there, we'll have another 30 minutes of discussion, again with 3 minutes per contribution. And then we'll end with a round of sum ups. What's the conclusion for DSA for the socialist movement? We'll have 10 minutes each for Andy and Brandon to speak then, and then we'll just sort of wrap up from there. So just to start off, I mentioned those three important questions we'll start off with. First of them is, first of all, what went wrong in the Bowman discussion? So if I can, we'll start off with Andy. Go ahead, Andy.
Hey, my name's Andy Cernatinger. I'm a member of the Tempest Collective, and I guess I write on DSA a lot, and was involved in what we're calling the Bowman Affair. What I'm realizing from where we're starting this conversation is like people are sort of all over the place about what they know about what happened, right? So some people are aware like Bowman did bad things, then people got mad and called for, discipline, and then it didn't happen. So I want to start by introducing like what happened and then talk about where things went wrong. If you didn't follow this whole thing, right, Jamal Bowman was a congressional U.S. congressional candidate in New York City. He is in the Lower Hudson Valley branch of the New York City chapter. Last year, there were two candidates, two progressive or left or whatever candidates that were competing for the endorsement for DSA. Bowman was one of them. Ondam was the other. One of the key distinguishing things was their position on BDS, and Bowman didn't actually win the endorsement, as far as I'm aware, until after Ondam dropped out. And then NYC DSA didn't endorse because of a lot of that. And then DSA National endorsed anyway. So even though he didn't get the chapter endorsement. So he, you know, Bowman ended up winning and then, you know, did what he said he was going to do. So in May, he started speaking out against BDS, kind of positing himself as like, you know, an ally to Israel, but, you know, like somebody that cares about the horrible things that are happening to Palestinians. He, you know, was pretty vocal about that, did some media tours about his positions opposing boycott, divest, and sanction. And starting in the spring, DSA's National BDS and Palestine Working Group reached out to him to talk about what DSA's official position was and to try to move him to be like, all right, you're like, you are you're a member, you're an endorsed candidate, you're speaking against our position. Do you not understand it? Like, so they're in direct contact with them. This was, you know, as early as June. So I make that explicitly clear because one of the things that people have said is, well, Bowman was never afforded the opportunity to understand what was wrong and didn't get a chance to correct his actions. This has been something where people have been in direct contact with him for many months. So at the end of July, he voted in favor of $3.3 billion of direct military aid to Israel. And then at the end of September, again, another $1 billion to replenish the Iron Dome missile defense system in Israel. And that's when chapters kind of started this movement to get some kind of discipline on the congressman. So first, there was a petition put forward by the Marxist Unity Group calling for, I think, censure. And then not long after that were calls for expulsions that moved from chapter to chapter. Those were sort of slow going. And then at the beginning of November, Bowman went and took a propaganda tour of Israel. Posed in some photos with the far right minister, Naftali Bennett, and foreign minister Yair Lapid. And, you know, that was really like pushing it in everyone's face, and people had really had enough. So there were these rolling calls, chapters voting, calling for expulsion of Bowman. A second kind of counter movement that never got any chapter endorsements to my knowledge, but had some prominent people sign on to it saying, don't expel him. The NPC acknowledged it in November, and then they set up a meeting with Bowman. They met with him, had negotiations with him, tried to say, okay, like, this is really it. Like, don't do this stuff. He went and did a town hall with the propaganda group J Street on November 29th anyway. And that's when the DSA BDS working group kind of had enough and they made their own call for expulsion. So this was a rolling series of events. It's not like, you know, day one, people don't like something. Day two, they call for expulsion, right? I mean, you're talking about months. And then the NPC basically has some closed door negotiations with Bowman. The topics are never revealed. They then on December 2nd come out and say that they have voted against expulsion, against censure, and against revocation of his endorsement. And they just basically said, well, that's no good. So like one thing that went very wrong, obviously, the process, you know, no discussion, no ability for members to have any direct input on this. I would argue that members definitely wanted action on Bowman, but we didn't have something like a referendum. And last thing I'll say is the underlying logic here that's really created this problem is a political logic of electoralism, which is that there's more value on elected officials and our relationship to them than any of our political principles or positions as an organization.
Thank you so much, Andy. Go ahead, Brandon, same question. What went wrong in the Bowman discussion?
Thanks. Yeah, I think first off, before jumping into that, I just want to make it clear right off the bat that I believe voting for military aid to Israel or any other similarly oppressive regime, that's a clear red line that it's 100% unacceptable for a socialist representative of all people to cross. I understand that, you know, Israel and Palestine pose some difficult questions for socialists, but this was not one of those questions. This was not about the nuance of position on BDS or a future one state versus two state solution or anything like that. This was about military armament in a war waged to keep the West Bank occupied under Israeli control and to continue the siege against Gaza. This was about an immediate follow-up visit that included an uncritical photo op with a right-wing Israeli prime minister, not with any focus on raising the movement's concerns, which would have been one thing, but simply lending his left credibility to a far-right politician. I don't think there can be any justification for that. But in terms of what went wrong in the discussion inside DSA, to me, the most important thing that went wrong is that DSA's NPC, the National Political Committee, never organized any open democratic debate on the subject. The reason I'm focusing on that question of method is I think that's in many ways a more important issue than what decision was taken with respect to disciplining Bowman in this specific instance, because insofar as DSA continues to experience electoral successes, this issue is just going to keep coming up again and again and again. So we need to learn the lessons of what went wrong here and establish a better precedent, a better model going forward. From the beginning, as Andy mentioned, this issue was dealt with in closed door executive sessions of the NPC or in private meetings between the NPC and Bowman. And there's nothing wrong with having those types of meetings in and of themselves, but when you only have those types of meetings and it's not paired with any meetings that are out in the open, to me, that is a problem. And even in the extended report that the NPC eventually released to DSA membership, there's important political context left out. And to this day, we only know about that because of individual NPC members leaking that to the rest of DSA. So for example, Jenbo from the NPC revealed that another member of the NPC threatened to quit the organization and lead the charge against DSA as being a racist organization. If the NPC majority voted to expel Bowman, they said that prominent DSA public figures would leave the organization with them. Aaron from the NPC also seemed to corroborate that in his comments. There was at least one other NPC member that said they didn't take that specific threat seriously, but they also agreed that how other DSA elected officials would react was very much a concern that was part of the discussion, part of what the NPC was grappling with, even independently of whether this specific threat of a split was seen as something to be taken seriously or not. However, that concern is totally absent from the official report. Nowhere is the threat of a split, whether implied or explicit, mentioned as a factor that the NPC took into consideration. And to be clear, my problem here isn't with the NPC letting the danger of a split influence their decision. I mean, let's not pretend they can just ignore those things. Certainly threats or political blackmail can be real factors in wise tactical decision-making, and they can reveal power dynamics that you want to take into account. But while fully acknowledging that we have no way of knowing exactly how much teeth this particular threat had, the fact remains that if political representatives, prominent representatives of DSA really were willing to come out in favor of leaving DSA and calling it a racist organization, that would constitute a genuine problem. And I think that would not only because it reveals regard for the organization's democracy on the part of the blackmailers, but even then, I think it could still be correct in the short term for the rest of the NPC to make some organizational compromises with those members to try to buy some time. But in that case, they would still need to use that time to try to regain the initiative and try to shift the balance of forces in DSA by systematically educating the rest of the organization and its followers about the questions involved, including an open and honest discussion in DSA about the power of elected officials and the pressures weighing on them, which, by the way, are the same pressures that are inevitably going to be faced by any prominent leadership of a working class organization going forward. So in that case, the strategic aim would be to overcome such a threat and politically prepare the organization in such a way to minimize the potential damage that could be done by a split. However, and this is my last point, the strategy of covering up that threat, of publishing a statement claiming that you freely arrived at the position that you were blackmailed into in some respects, that's to me the opposite of working towards overcoming those types of threats. It actually entrenches and reinforces the unhealthy power dynamic and effectively constitutes an invitation for the same situation to occur again in the future.
Thank you so much, Brandon. All right. Just to follow up with that question, the related issue, how to liberate Palestine, what's the role of socialists in the US? So this time we'll reverse it. We'll start with Brandon. Go ahead, Brandon, 5 minutes.
Sounds good. Well, as a Marxist, I'm of the opinion that if Palestine is going to be liberated and imperialist domination against it defeated, then the movement to do so has to be led first and foremost by the Palestinian masses themselves, with the working class playing a leading role. So the closest example I could point to in terms of what's needed would be something along the lines of the first Intifada in the late 1980s. That was an uprising based on thousands of bottom-up committees of struggle, which organized a mass nationally coordinated protest movement, employing a variety of fighting tactics all the way up to and including armed resistance. And as far as what socialists in the US can do, we can play an auxiliary role in supporting that by offering vocal political support for Palestinian liberation and by building the strongest possible movement to boycott and divest from companies and organizations that support or profit from the illegal settlements, the occupation, the siege, the displacements carried out against the Palestinian people. And of course, our number one target should be to try to cut off all US military aid to Israel. In terms of the politics that I think would make for the strongest international movement on those fronts, I would summarize it in 6 points. First, I think we need an independent working class position that's rooted in anti-imperialism and anti-capitalism. As I mentioned, I think it needs to involve the number two, full liberation of Palestinians from below, where the Palestinian people are the key agents of liberation themselves, and where that liberation involves in the occupation and siege, the right to return for all refugees, full rights for Palestinians and all minorities in Israel. Three, I think the movement needs to be clearly based on zero tolerance for anti-Semitism and a recognition that that is a real thing and a dangerous thing that we want no part of or association with. Four, I think the imperialist-backed IDF, Israeli Defense Force, is a key obstacle that has to be overcome. And so in recognizing that, we need a strategy to undermine them, to lower their morale in the fight, and if possible, turn sections of the IDF against the brass. Five, I think we need support for democratic rights for all people and minorities in Israel and Palestine, including the right to self-determination for all peoples. And six, I think we need a opposition to all ethnic cleansing or to basing any state on the idea of ethnic purity. So that would mean any Jewish majority nation needs to have full and equal rights for Arab people. Any Arab majority nation needs to have full and equal rights for Jewish people, et cetera. Full and equal rights for all minority populations. And then finally, in terms of strategy and tactics for a successful BDS movement, I guess I would advocate for a sort of divide and conquer approach of sorts. And what I mean by that is the movement should focus its fire as sharply as possible against specifically those who profit from, justify, or help continue the oppression of Palestinians in the occupied territories of the West Bank, in Gaza, in the refugee camps outside of Israel and Palestine, and within Israel itself. I think the goal should be to deepen the dividing line between those institutions and the rest of Israeli society so that we maximize pressure on them and cut them off as much as possible from potential sources of social and political support. And so I think BDS has been most successful when it has selected targets in that sort of more strategic and specific fashion. I think its biggest weak point right now is the fact that sometimes it has a tendency to target like virtually any person or institution operating in Israel, like say all Israeli academics or something like that. And I think that's not the most effective way. I think the pressure that Bowman and AOC came under here shows how strong the US sentiment is of protecting Israeli Jewish people, which in my opinion is quite understandable given the experience of the Holocaust, the ongoing anti-Semitism in the US and globally, the indiscriminate terror attacks that Hamas and other Palestinian groups have unfortunately carried out. And so if we target all of Israeli society, we make it much easier for our opponents to mobilize that sentiment against our movement. The left, including our public representatives, I think are going to be far more effective in pushing back against that and in fighting to win majority support if we make clear that we are not against all entities operating in Israel, but that we're 100% against the EF and Israeli institutions that are actively enforcing or profiting from the occupation of the West Bank, the siege of Gaza, and so on. So that would be my take.
All right. Thank you, Brandon. And same question, Andy. How to liberate Palestine? What's the role of socialists in the U.S.?
Well, there's some stuff I'll agree with Brandon on. I mean, obviously, the liberation of a people is dependent on, you know, their self-activity. And like our role generally is to dismantle the structures that we can that are obstacles to that. And being in the U.S., like obviously the U.S. state has an enormous investment in Israel as a sort of satellite as for its imperial ambitions. And so, you know, this is part of the reason why the Bowman thing is such a big deal, is because should we be voting for $3 to $5 billion of direct military aid, you'd think that your basic would be like, no, don't do that. But if you have people that are supposed to be socialists who are members of your own organization that are putting forward a position about the liberation of Palestine, arming the apartheid state, then you get a big fucking problem. So I think one of our duties is to make sure that we are, you know, keeping our people accountable and making sure that we're not legitimizing apartheid, which I think has been one of the consequences of this, is people are really divided, but within DSA, but not because of a moral question about Palestine. The whole reason why people were taking positions about it was entirely about the access to power that Bowman has for other issues. And so I think you can't, you know, make Palestine a chip that's to be bargained with for other issues. Like, that is one of the huge problems here, is that DSA failed a big test where we said, do we hold our position on stuff, or is that something that's negotiable while we try to ally with someone for a Green New Deal for public schools or something like that? And like, that sucks. That's a horrible takeaway for a lot of members. And I think a lot of members wouldn't accept it. And that's why there's the dissent that there has been. But we also have a duty to honor the calls of Palestinian civil society. And one of the main call has been for boycott, divest, and sanction, BDS. So we have to, if we are actually in solidarity with the Palestinian movement and Palestinian people, then we should take seriously the things that they ask of their allies. BDS is one of those. I mean, ultimately, the liberation of Palestine is going to require the end of the apartheid state. It's not a reformable state, in my opinion. And I think this where I'll differ with Brandon is, I think it's pretty utopian to think that that there's going to be like a change in the disposition of Israelis as things are. One of those is because of how much material support goes from like the US to Israel to continue doing what they're doing. You know, there's a huge incentive to keep settling and displacing Palestine and like having ethnic cleansing. But, you know, even if you look at the polling among, you know, Israeli civilians about where they stand on these things, there's overwhelming support. So I think, you know, it would be nice to hope that there will be support within Israel for the end of this regime, but I don't think that is primarily the place where it's going to happen. And we shouldn't put those things on equal footing right now. I think it's also not solely up to, you know, what's going on in Israel. I think there's going to have to be probably a larger movement across the Arab world about, you know, rejecting how Israel has tried to really colonize and govern the entire area. And I think that's part of where the Arab Spring took a lot of its inspiration and spread, is because of this question. So I mean, for us, you know, if I were to throw that around, don't give our legitimacy to apartheid, honor BDS, and, you know, like make sure our socialist organization is upholding our principles.
All right. Thank you so much. And then there's one more follow-up question here that I'd like to ask both of our panelists. And given all this, how can we hold elected officials accountable? And same as before, we'll reverse it one more time. So go ahead, Andy, we'll start with you.
All right. Well, I think people should be really clear about why this was the issue that it was in DSA. You know, like some people were like, well, why this one and not something else? That is because Bowman is a member of DSA. Like Ilhan Omar is not a member of DSA. So we have a different relationship to them. And so one of those questions was, are we condoning the behavior of people in our own organization? Is somebody with greater power and influence that bears our name, are we going to accept that they're going to do things like give billions of dollars to apartheid? And what we can't do is we don't literally have the power to remove them from Congress, but we can do is withdraw our support from them, which DSA refused to do in any way, shape, or form. So DSA didn't expel Bowman. And let's be clear that expelling Bowman from DSA does not mean that Bowman would no longer be a congressperson. We don't have that power. But it would also make it very clear that, you know, our support is not unconditional. You have to do things to get it. If you get our support unconditionally, then there is no reason for anybody to humor any of our demands because they just know that they'll get it for free. So there have to be consequences. Otherwise, they're just going to, you know, accept people to phone bank and door knock and give them money. And then they'll go cater to the people who are threatening to withdraw the support. Like, I'm sorry, that's how it works. You know, like we haven't meaningfully distinguished in DSA the different relationships of people. Like, it's a complete fiction to say that Bowman is a member just like any other member, because he's not. I mean, he has power. He's an elected official. We should have greater sense of responsibility and duty to like from those people that have more power to affect things, not less. And the reason why there was pushback on the right of DSA for this is because they don't believe in membership running things. They believe in the expediency of elected officials who have like access to the gates of power. And that primarily that is all about an electoral vision. Change is going to come, in their opinion, from, you know, electing people and DSA accumulating relationships with individual politicians. And that's where we're going to get. This is a totally incrementalist approach. It's very cynical about our idea of collective power to achieve things. And I think we have to reject that. We have to say, like, you know, we're a principled organization, our banner matters, and we're going to protect it. So, you know, that's, again, withdraw support if we need to, give support to people who really deserve it, right? And I think we have to be accountable in our own organization to decisions made. Like, there is no way that we're going to accomplish this when there's shortcuts all around for people to, you know, get jobs as, you know, aides to politicians, or, you know, see their little pet projects move forward, because there's no transparency. All this stuff is happening behind closed doors and there's no democratic checks. We need to democratize our organization, like we need to democratize society. And we have to treat all of these elected officials with the greater scrutiny, and be prepared to hold their feet to the fire. And there's no such thing as uncritical support for socialists. If you think that, then we're already losing. So I'll stop right there.
All right. Thank you, Andy. Go ahead, Brandon.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, my position is expulsions and determining how much support we give to people, those are important, but they are not enough. I think we need to do more in terms of holding elected officials accountable. And so you know, whether or not Bowman were to be expelled, I think the NPC here missed a chance here to use this discussion and Jamal Bowman's prominence to raise public awareness about DSA's position. I think it could have called a public town hall event to discuss issues surrounding Israel, Palestine, BDS, figures like AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, as well as Jamal Bowman should have been informed that as DSA electeds, they're expected to attend and engage. There should be invited speakers representing the Palestinian liberation movement on the ground. AOC should have to answer for her abstention on the Iron Dome vote. Bowman should have to answer for everything we've been talking about. And say activists from around the country should have the democratic opportunity to explain directly to Bowman and AOC why we think they've been wrong about this and how deeply damaging it is for the socialist and Palestinian movement. This gives a more realistic precedent, in my opinion, of how DSA can hold public officials to account while at the same time pushing forward the broader agenda of mass public education on these issues. I think expulsion is a lot more politically effective if it comes as the culmination of a whole process of well-organized democratic discussion and debate. On its own, expulsion doesn't do that much to address the underlying issue, which is that, you know, support for Palestinian liberation is currently an unpopular minority position in the US, including among the working class, to be frank. And that's the fundamental dynamic we need to be struggling to change. It's first and foremost a political question, not something that we can shortcut around, but if we take the right organizational measures or exact the right punishments. These town hall style events could also have been spaced to have direct and open comradely debate on points of disagreement among DSA activists, such as, you know, what is the best program for DSA to have on Palestinian liberation, or how do we wage the strongest and most effective BDS campaigns? And of course, whatever we decide, our public reps are going to have a key role in carrying that out in practice and helping to popularize it. So they need to be required to be involved in those conversations as well. And I think that would help politicize the discussion and move it away from being treated as a sort of abstract moralistic question, which I think is something I believe, unfortunately, our wing of DSA represented here, sort of the wing that stressed the need to take decisive corrective action toward accountability after the Iron Dome vote. I think we've too often fell into that mistake during this debate sometimes. And by demanding Bowman and the other DSA members of Congress attend something like these town hall meetings, we would also be able to equalize their public profile to raise awareness and attention for DSA's event and for DSA's political arguments for BDS. And of course, if Bowman were to refuse to engage, or if he didn't show any openness to budge on his position, then expulsion absolutely is still on the table. I think it should always be on the table. And there'd be even clearer rationale for it. And even if Bowman were to be expelled before that and is already outside the organization, the rest of the town hall is, in my opinion, still well worth doing and would likely have more of a public impact than a simple expulsion. I do think expulsion is sometimes necessary, but its use, even when it's correct and justified, in my opinion, more often reflects a position of weakness than one of strength for DSA. It's a bit too much like, you know, you've given up all attempts of holding our public representative to account, or giving up on the authority of using the elected official that DSA has helped to build to promote our ideas, and instead sort of letting them off the hook from any obligation to represent or engage with DSA in the future. If that's the best we can achieve, then absolutely, I think members of DSA should support that. That is still much better than being politically unclear about where DSA stands and miseducating our members and our followers. But if there's a way we can exert even pressure on our representatives to have to answer to the movement, then in my opinion, that better. Finally, I think the entire situation surrounding the present debate underscores the need for there to be a well-organized Marxist wing in DSA that prepares in advance for the very probable scenario that elected representatives of DSA try at some stage to blackmail the organization into accepting unprincipled positions and threaten a split. I think this Bowman affair is just an initial prologue or a foreshadowing of the fact that if DSA is successful in its electoral endeavors, then far bigger crises involving even more political representatives are going to happen in the future.
I realize that we're going to move to the Q&A for a minute, but do you mind if I respond to some of that? I feel like there were some pretty big things in there I'd like to tackle.
Well, you did end your time early a couple times. So if you want to take like the 2 minutes that you left unused,
sure,
go ahead and plug.
All right. So there's a few things that you said, and I'm not trying to, you know, jump on you, but first, you know, we're socialists. We're going to take some unpopular stances. It's a principled stance, and we want to win people to that. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that we're always going to be in the majority. When we have to fight for the liberation of oppressed people, there's going to be ruling class attitudes that, you know, the majority and shape people, and we will be in the minority sometimes. Like, often we are. We're in the minority about socialism, but we're still fighting for that and saying that we're into that. You know, I kind of reject the idea that we were moralistic about Bowman. I mean, I think you and others have said that this is a red line, right? I mean, how many times do you vote to give billions of dollars before that's too many times? I think once is probably too many times. That shouldn't have happened. But I went through the, you know, at the beginning, the timeline of things where he had multiple opportunities to correct behavior and chose not to. He's not interested in that. I don't, you know, we have, yes, it would be excellent to have a better democratic culture and to have the opportunity for all these things to happen. But in the situation that we find ourselves, we have none of those mechanisms. We have, so what is the response that members should have? And I think that given where we are in the progression of events, this was entirely appropriate and actually necessary. And, you know, in fact, the democratic thing that, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of members in DSA were calling for, you know, you have entire chapters, dozens and dozens of chapters that were making this call. So the real problem here is that the representation structure of DSA is so divorced from anything that even when we do, you know, get to some semblance of bottom-up democracy, they just were not interested. This is the main problem, is that, yes, they could have had a debate. Yes, they could have opened this question up, but they didn't do any of that. They didn't take a poll. We have the opportunity to poll right now, but they're not interested. So that's where I think we have to be militant about our demands.
All right, thank you, Andy. As was mentioned, we are moving into the open discussion portion. So we're going to have 25 minutes here to take contributions from anybody. If you want to speak, I sort of gave the name wrong earlier. We actually have a dedicated Stack Here name that you can direct message. So send Stack, the word Stack, or just your name or whatever to that if you want to get on Stack. And we'll get started, though, with we have some names already. So Mike Dewar, with a question, you have up to 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, and thanks so much for putting on this event. And I definitely agree with everybody here that this is an important discussion to have. I'll preface by saying that I was actually a signatory of the Unitary Not Unanimity Statement, and was pretty vocal in my chapter against a local resolution calling to expel. But the reason I was that I was very, very concerned that, you know, despite, I think Andy brought this up, you know, oh, there's a clear differential between, you know, who Bowman is and who an ordinary member is. You know, it's clearly apparent that somebody with material power to act is different from an ordinary member. The mechanism being proposed for expulsion was the same for ordinary members as it would be for Bowman. And I guess my question to both of the panelists and anybody else in the crowd is, you know, not would you accept it as a precondition, because I'm in no position to offer it. And, you know, everybody has already said pretty much on this call that they're pro-expel. But do you think it's a path forward for developing a more coherent politics within the organization? and for having these discussions to clearly in the bylaws define, you know, endorsed public officials and elected members as, you know, as different within the bylaws from ordinary members. Because I care a lot about the ideological big tent for ordinary members, but I definitely accept that we need a more coherent position with elected officials. And I'm sort of thinking through this both within my chapter and, you know, how we relate to our local elected officials and also maybe, you know, as we get towards 2023, how to move forward from this. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Next up, we have a couple names already. Noel, go ahead. You have 3 minutes.
All right. Yeah. How's my video here? No. Let's see. Yeah. So I think a lot of this kind of misses the point. Or no. Let me start over. I think something here deeper than just like particular red lines that are crossed, and, you know, make no mistake, the lines that Bowman crossed are very red. I think a lot of it also is just stemming from a fundamental misunderstanding of what socialists' roles should be, you know, in electoral politics, how we actually participate in the electoral arena. Like, we're not, if we go into, you know, elected office with the idea that we're there to make policy, we're there to get certain legislation through and all that, you know, that's not where, you know, our strength is. That's, you know, sorry, I don't have notes in front of me for this, but like, we need to approach elected office with the idea that we're going into hostile territory. You know, we're not there just to wheel and deal and make policy. Like, we're there to use that as an organizing tool and, you know, point out the sham of, you know, bourgeois democracy. We're there to build our movements, or at least we should be there as the primary concern. And, you know, if we get legislation passed, it's not going to be because we have, you know, this or that elected official. It's going to be because we have a movement on the ground, in the workplaces, in the streets, scaring the living hell out of bourgeois politicians. And all of our electoral efforts need to have that in mind. And, you know, the Reform and Revolution Caucus, you know, has it right that we need to fight for both reforms and build for revolution, but we don't get reforms based, you know, just on having more and more socialist politicians in office. We get reforms based on the struggle in the streets and workplaces. And, you know, our elected officials need to go in with that as, like, building that as their main goal. And again, pointing out the sham of bourgeois democracy, I'd like to point to an excellent, to an excellent book on the topic of revolutionary parliamentarism by August Nimtz, The Ballot, the Streets, or Both. I think it's an excellent history of like how the Bolsheviks in Tsarist Russia handled, electoral politics, you know, having their elected representatives, you know, do things and get, you know, publicity that, you know, even legally then nobody else could. We're in a different situation now, but, you know, many of the factors still hold true of,
yeah. Noel, you're at time if you can wrap up.
All right. Yeah. I can put a link to that book in the chat. I think more DSAers should probably read it to inform our electoral practice.
All right. Thank you so much. Next up, I have Luke Brannigan. Before you go, I just want to, I guess I didn't really tell people how I was going to warn people about time, but I'll send you a direct message when you've got a minute left, and then I'll let you know when you're at time. And I'll come in verbally if you go past that so that we can keep it tight and make sure everybody has a chance to speak. So go ahead, Luke Brannigan. Luke, if you're trying to speak right now, we can't hear you. You might be muted.
Thank you.
Okay.
Just to expound on the good points that Mike and Noel both made, because everything I've heard, I think are very valid concerns. So Bowman's vote was undeniably bad. My concern is that his immediate concerns once he's in office is support for Israel is really just a symbolic concern, whereas the concerns of the Palestinian people are very real, and our need to demonstrate solidarity with the Palestinian people and oppressed people all over the world and in our communities is of vital importance. The extent to which an elected official is able to defy party discipline is the extent that the party is separated from the consciousness and empowerment of workers. That's just sort of like a comment that I wrote down as a general concern. Now, to kind of pose a long form question here, Bowman's vote was, and in addition, a Marxist party is not concerned with access to power, but access to the working class. It's just my opinion. So what is a more important issue, the involvement in the BDS movement or our ability to assert party discipline among our members? Obviously, it's a frustrating case because DSA has become an org that gives an avenue to, opportunist politicians to take office on the national stage. I wonder, is this a contradiction that's inherent in participation in electoralism, or are there mechanisms that can be built into an org that weed out opportunists before they're able to reach the national stage so that we can't be used as a stepping stone for somebody else's political ambitions? And that was really more important of a question than, obviously, our involvement in the BDS movement is absolutely crucial, but our ability to assert party discipline among our members seems to be very concerning. And I give my time.
All right. Thank you so much, Luke. Next up, we have Julia. And just a reminder for everybody, if you want to get on Stack, please just directly message Stack here. And then as a reminder for the time, try to keep your comments to 2 to 3 minutes. All right, go ahead, Julia, thank you.
Thank you so much. Something that came up in Stack was somebody said the Democratic Party is fundamentally an imperialist project. I'm thinking that perhaps the greater problem is that America itself is fundamentally an imperialist and settler colonial project. And as a result, the legitimacy of Israel is in some ways tied to the legitimacy of, America and Canada and Australia and so on. And that's one of the things that makes it somewhat difficult to hold the line on this position. To be clear, I don't believe any of those countries are legitimate, but I'm wondering, how do we hold elected, what can we do in terms of holding elected representatives accountable And do people think that there's perhaps far too much emphasis on who is in the government versus what it is doing? How do we draw those lines in terms of the interconnected sort of settler colonial projects?
All right, thank you, Julia. Next up, we have Ty. Go ahead, Ty.
Well, to me, one of the biggest questions that comes out of this that I'd like to hear the speakers talk to is, you know, there's debate on the left about what, you know, on the left wing of DSA, we're having some debate about what the meaning of all these experiences have been. But I think the overarching question that we probably all agree on is the way the NPC handled it, the way a large, probably at this stage, dominant wing of DSA handled it, leaves us with a lot of foreboding. That they're not, that the politics, the approach points toward, you know, future betrayals like this, not just on the question of, and that our national organization is not going to use whatever levers and tools it has available, from expulsion to sort of organizing mass pressure from below, which I think is the more important thing, to hold people accountable. And, you know, the bright line of funding for the Israeli military is not the only issue. You know, AOC voted for Pelosi as Speaker of the House. There's been a lot of actions taken and approaches taken that are not consistent with DSA's policies by our elected officials. But so these are issues that are going to come up again and again. And I don't think there's a magic way to say, well, we'll only elect people who are somehow have a magic immunity from opportunism. That's opportunism is not a, you know, DNA trait of candidates. It's a pressure that it gets exerted when you get into office. The best people will collapse under those pressures without a mass movement, a mass organization, a coherent policy to help push them, to keep them accountable. And to me, the question for the left is, how do we get effectively organized within DSA to use events like the Bowman thing, the danger is people are just walking away from DSA. Oh, look, DSA is, not going to keep their people accountable, and the left-wing people walk out. I think we should be saying, no, we need to do the exact opposite. This is a clarion call to get organized as a left, to have a more coherent set of proposals for how the organization should run elections, should deal with electoral work, and link that to movement building work. You know, just to, you know, for those who know these historical references, you know, what should Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg have done in advance? Their big mistake was they didn't get organized enough in advance of the right wing of the Social Democratic Party in Germany preparing in the run up to World War I. And they were not prepared. They didn't have a coherent force to use that crisis to win a majority over to a revolutionary or more left wing policy. They were left, you know, disorganized, and took them a long time to regather themselves, regather the left wing of the party together. We should take the lesson. I mean, there's obviously limits to that. We're not the social, we don't have a third of Congress like the Social Democrats in Germany did at that time. So, you know, all that understanding aside, I think we should take this as a warning that the left needs to get organized inside DSA to try and fight for power, not to try and, project a politics and an aura that self-marginalizes us and that points toward probably we should just walk out. That's the wrong direction, at least at this stage.
Thank you, Ty. Next up, we have Dallas.
Hi, can you hear me? Great, thanks. Pleasure hearing everybody speak today. I guess my only contribution would be, I just don't think there's a place in national at all in the discussion. Seems like maybe a national endorsement was a mistake in the first place. They overstepped their place by not following the lead of the local NYC chapters. And this seems to be an NYC specific issue. I mean, AOC and Bowman both represent districts in New York City. We know that the Zionist lobby is pretty influential in New York City, and that influence tends to stay within New York City, right? Doesn't tend to stray too far outside of. Can you hear me now?
I could still hear you.
Okay. I just saw Jacob type in chat. In any case, the influence is concentrated in New York City. So if the local chapters didn't feel that Bowman was strong enough on the issue, then National shouldn't have extended the endorsement. That said, doesn't seem like National should then follow up by expelling Bowman either. Rather, it seems like corrective action should be taken by New York City DSA. It should stay a local issue, should have been a local issue. I know I'm coming from Chicago DSA. We had our own issues both with BDS, specifically our Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa. He was selected as a lieutenant governor pick for Daniel Biss, and it was a dust up. He stuck to his principles and he lost his spot as lieutenant governor. I appreciate him for sticking by his guns on that issue. But then we had another alderman, Alderman Vasquez, who went against the chapter on a vote regarding civilian oversight of police here in Chicago. It again was a dust up. He was wanting to see compromise. The chapter was pretty clear on where we stood in favor of the accountability board. And ultimately, I would have been pretty annoyed had National stepped in and done anything, inserted themselves into the problem at all. I really do think that, you know, local chapters should stick to their own business, that National just is not a very mature organization at all. The ways that we interact with National just aren't very real for many of us, unless you are in a national committee of some sort. I'm not on a national committee, and there's no real avenue of engagement for me to National, except for these weird instances of like viral social media engagement. I really just think that all of these should stay at a local level, and National should kind of support locals instead of overstepping them bounds. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Dallas. Next up, we have Jacob S.
Yeah, so as Andy was saying, or Andy seemed to be saying in his last contribution, that this debate isn't really about BDS and anti-imperialism, that the debate that has happened within DSA, what it's really about is organizational democracy. And I think that's definitely part of it. It's definitely important. I'm not sure that's really the central thing. The basic question seems to be, is there something to be gained by having these high profile paper members in elected office, even when they do not support the democratically agreed upon positions of the organization? And honestly, a majority of the organization seems to think that yes, there is, based on how they vote in the convention. Even if a conflagration like that, like what's going on now or what has been going on emerges from time to time. And it's a fundamental disagreement about whether DSA should be a left Democrat pressure group or the beginnings of an independent socialist party. And I think when you put it in those terms, it makes the whole thing less sort of confusing and frustrating. It's like, of course they wouldn't want to set your Bowman. Of course they'd rather split than do that. They have an entirely different set of goals and aspirations than, you know, these various Marxist groups on the left of DSA. And given all of that, it would seem like directing this debate in that direction, to show the real stakes of this, to show that this isn't the debate about DSA's relationship with the Democratic Party is not some abstract thing for the future. It has real implications now in incidents like this. That would be a productive direction to go.
All right. Thank you so much, Jacob. Next up, we have Ryan M.
You can hear me okay? Great, awesome. Ryan Mosgrove here, Metro DC chapter, he, him pronouns. Thank you for comrades for organizing this. It's been a good discussion. Just want to kind of make a couple points. I mean, one, I think that there is sort of like, you know, as far as like DSA goes, as far as like, you know, those of us here who are DSA members, you know, I think the organizational component that other people have raised is really important because, you know, in the broader left and how this is sort of discussed, a lot of emphasis has, you know, correctly been put on, you know, Bowman and Bowman's role and, you know, why Bowman did this and so on, broader implications for, you know, the limitations of electoral politics, which is all, you know, points well taken. This was also, as other comrades mentioned, like a massive failure organizationally. It's a massive failure of leadership. And as a DSA member, that's kind of how I personally interpret events. I mean, as far as, you know, the formal positions of the organization, there was absolutely no reason to tolerate what Bowman did. I mean, the position of the organization is extremely clear as far as, you know, the positions the membership have put forward at conventions around, you know, BDS and Palestine and so on and so on. Our bylaws are pretty clear about, you know, the sort of, you know, latitude or powers that the leadership have to, you know, enforce accountability. You know, and, you know, one of the first comments you spoke raised the idea of a bylaw amendment or things like this. I think there's the sad reality is that, you know, our bylaws do support, you know, have a basis for the kind of actions people were calling for, and they were just ignored. You know, the mandates of the convention were ignored. These things were just ignored. So it's not really a question of, you know, on paper what you know, positions are passed. Membership passed their positions, made their points clear, and the leadership ignored it, and did what they wanted to do, and created whatever basis they wanted to support that. I think that, you know, Ty's points earlier, I think are right on point. Couldn't agree more, you know, that we have to have a plan. As far as DSA members, you know, the broader left, people who aren't DSA are going to draw their own conclusions. And I certainly don't blame people who feel like this is not a reason, this is a good reason to leave DSA. But I think, yeah, we have to be organized, and we have to be pushing for, you know, real reform, real changes in how the organization operates, how our leadership operates, so that issues like this don't happen again in the future, because, you know, we need an organization, just period, flat out. We can't do without it. I mean, it's great to talk about movements. Movements don't really scare people in power, and they can also be leveraged against us as well. Like we saw how, you know, statements from the BDS, you know, BDS campaign itself were then, you know, leveraged and, you know, by the leadership cynically to justify their decision and so on. And it sounds like there was, you know, back dealings going on there too. So, you know, movements are great, but they're also, you know, they have their limitations. We need organization. We need, you know, to not let this sort of situation that we're in of, you know, having a mass organization, a semi-mass organization in the United States for the first time in a long time, sort of slip away from us and retreat back into sort of movement politics.
All right. Thank you so much, Ryan. Next up, we have Steve L. And then we'll do Stefan, and then we'll move to the panelists for brief intermission, I suppose, before going back to the open discussion. But go ahead, Steve.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for this discussion. Member of Seattle Revolutionary Socialists. I want to agree with what Jacob and Noel have said, and other people as well. We need to understand that the DSA representatives who are in Congress, those who are in DSA or supported by DSA, are basically left liberals. You know, they make nice sounding statements, but they're fundamentally pro-imperialist, vote for the military budget, don't have a good position on immigration, for example, basically support Biden, push Biden a little bit, but support him. So they're not really socialists. So basically, what DSA is doing by claiming that these people are socialists is defaming what the whole idea of socialism is all about. It's not, you know, it's not liberal reform. It's replacement of the whole capitalist system. And so that's really, I think that's really the problem. The problem is not just Bowman. It's the whole DSA approach to the domination of electoralism is more important than anything else to DSA. DSA is fundamentally a reformist organization. There are Marxists within it, obviously, but it's fundamentally a reformist organization. And I would go back to Ty's point about how Rosa Luxemburg and so forth did not organize, you know, the left wing. And the reason they didn't do it correctly is because they stayed in the Social Democratic Party of Germany. That was the problem. They needed to separate out and form a revolutionary organization with a clear revolutionary position. And that's what they did not do. And that's the lesson I believe that Marxists within DSA need to learn. They need to pull out of DSA and form an actual revolutionary organization that can put forward a clear revolutionary position. And until that's done, you're going to be the tail of a rightward moving pro-democratic party operation. So anyway, that's my position. Thanks a lot, everybody.
All right. Thank you, Steve. And then last, we have Stefan before moving to the panelists. Go ahead, Stefan.
Yeah, my name is Stefan. I'm active in Seattle DSA. And I'm a member of the Reform and Revolution Caucus. I wouldn't want to come in a little bit on the question of strategy, how to liberate Palestine. And Andy asked a little bit rhetorical, will Israeli Jewish people support the liberation of Palestinians? And I've been in Israel-Palestine. I've been, for example, at protest of Jewish and Palestinian people in Jerusalem against house demolitions in East Jerusalem. And it's, I fully agree, it's a tiny minority of Israeli Jewish people who engage in that. If we would wait for that, we would be lost. And I agree with what Aram put in the chat, where the Palestinians can't afford to wait until the Israeli working class becomes woke. I would add also, the Palestinians cannot wait for the US working class to wake up. So I would be in favor of resistance, and I am in favor of resistance, including armed resistance, according to the lines of the first Intifada, where 10,000 communities from below were developed. This is what's needed. And what we need to do is organize international solidarity for that. But is this a strategy to win? That's where I feel like there's something missing there. The IDF, backed by US imperialism and all the military support from the US, will such an armed resistance win, or is this just a strategy for an endless civil war? And that's where I feel like the discussion needs to move on. It's not about winning the Israeli Jewish working class to just such a position that I have or we have here today. The Vietnam War was won by the armed resistance in Vietnam, but then also a movement here that also, let's be clear, did not move a majority of the working class to a clear understanding of imperialism and opposition to that, but at least a position that this is an unwinnable war, that it needs to change and there are alternatives. And I feel like that is the challenge we have. This is linked to why do elected officials like Bowman or AOC with abstention, why do they get away with their position? And I not just mean not being expelled from the ESA, but get away in the public. It's not popular to spend this money abroad. But with Israel, I think there is this absolutely cynical exploitation of the experience of the Holocaust, of anti-Semitism. Just recently, the hostage taken in the synagogue in Texas. I think that's a question where we on the left in DSA are challenged to change the power dynamic there, that this can't happen, that we make it clear that there is no zero tolerance for the occupation, for repression, for votes like Bowman did. Zero tolerance to that. But that there is also a strategy to accept and acknowledge that the 6 or 7 million Israeli Jewish people are there to stay, and the solidarity that people feel in the also in the US globally, given the anti-Semitism, whatever. There is a lot of positive support there that I share, but that can't be exploited. And that's where I feel like the strategy of being clear of even supporting an intifada, but also being clear that the democratic rights also of Israeli Jewish people will be acknowledged, that we can talk about targeting those companies and corporations who benefit from the exploitation in the West Bank directly and so on, to have their clear focus to try to drive a wedge into that, not just in Israel, also in the US. I feel like that's a challenge for us to undermine then the support that people like Bowman and even AOC to a certain extent get for their cozying up with this far right-wing regime and US imperialist projects.
All right, perfect time. Thank you, Stefan. And I think it's about time we hear from our panelists again. So just starting with Brandon, go ahead. We'll do 5 minutes and then 5 minutes for Andy, and then we'll go back to another 30 minutes of open discussion before we close. Go ahead, Brandon.
Yeah, thanks. Well, first off, I could not agree more with the comments Stefan just made. I had many of those points ready in my notes for replying as well. So I appreciate those points and I endorse all of them. And yeah, so just to state my position clearly on that, I think when I talk about, you know, moralism or whatever, I saw some thing in the chat about how it's not moralism to oppose sending billions for imperialism. I agree. That's not what I was talking about. It was saying that it was what I was trying to draw attention to was the lack of a strategic thinking in terms of how we're going to actually be able to succeed in stopping those billions from being sent, how we're actually going to succeed in rising up in supporting the Palestinian people and rising up against their oppression. And I think, so that's the question. I think politically, we should be extremely firm and draw a clear line on these questions. And that's my top priority, is we draw a firm political red line of where we stand on these questions. But then that still leaves open the question of what is the strategy to actually win those things. And that's where I think the points that Stefan was bringing into that discussion, I think, are extremely relevant on that front. That as things stand right now, I agree, it's totally utopian that the Israeli working class is going to, you know, rise up against the current regime of oppression or whatever. I think if everything stays the same, that is not happening. That is not where things are at right now. But I do think that there are openings to drive a wedge between the Israeli working class and the Israeli regime. I won't get into all of them, but just to sort of bullet point, like there have been over the past 30 years, you know, student strikes, labor strikes, general strikes, occupations, and so on, against various attempts by the Israeli ruling class to impose austerity. And you have various forms of racialized inequality in Israel and things like that, that can be sticking points, that can be things that divide the population against the regime. So I think we should be looking to exploit those weak points, is what I'm getting at, that we want to strategically exploit the weak points of the IDF and the Israeli regime, both in terms of our strategy here with BDS, which is where the context in which I bring up the targeting is to divide and conquer by isolating as much as possible and turning other sections of Israeli and US society against those offenders as possible, that we sharpen the approach, and as well as in terms of the strategy that's going to be or the political content that's going to be necessary to try to win people to a majority. So another point, a broad point I wanted to address, is this idea that we're not always going to be in a majority. And I agree with that. I mean, the whole first chunk of my being a socialist activist starting in 2004 was just taking it for granted that socialists are not going to be a majority. I think, you know, in the post-Sanders world or whatever, I think there's a lot more people coming to it in a way where, with some expectation that the things we support are going to be popular. But I went into being a socialist with no such expectations. And so, yeah, I agree, we're not always going to be a majority, but I don't think we can ever stop trying to win a majority. I still believe that a mass movement of the working class is what's going to be necessary to win all the things that we're fighting for. And I think no amount of saying the right thing and standing on the right issues, I think that's necessary, but it's not sufficient. We still need to organize and win a working class majority for those issues. And so we can't afford to sort of set aside as unimportant the questions of how do we actually do that? How do we move in that direction? Because to me, giving up on being able to do that is equivalent to giving up on the project of building socialism in general, that we have to win the working class to that, or it's not going to happen. And then just I won't have time to get deep into this, but I think it'd be good to talk more also about concrete, like, structural changes and what accountability could look like going forward for DSA politicians. I think there needs to be a move in the direction of DSA, not just endorsing people who are already running, but sort of proactively running its own candidates and that have high expectations in terms of their acting as a representative of DSA in office, openly promoting DSA in its campaigns and building the movement through that, prioritizing, coordinating, collaborating with DSA on their work in office, forming a distinct socialist caucus in Congress where they work under the discipline of and hire DSA and socialist staffers. Anyway, I'm out of time, but those are some things that it would be good to dive into, and hopefully I'll be able to come back to at the end.
All right, thank you, Brandon. Go ahead, Andy, take 5 minutes.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way 5 minutes is gonna work to respond to everything that's been brought up, so I gotta pick and choose. I mean, I think the first things first, DSA's relationship to elected officials is, like Brandon was just saying, that we don't rear our own candidates and they're like trained in our politics. And then they, you know, then like we elevate them as like, you know, hardened people from the struggle. Like it's mostly like, oh, this progressive person is already running and they say they're a democratic socialist. That's great for us. And then, you know, we endorse them and they have almost no relationship to DSA. Like that's 95%, if not more, of DSA's elected officials, right? So why would they be interested in us primarily, right? Like that's not usually where their loyalty lies. They, you know, the question is usually, right, like who has the power to help them get what they want? Are we decisive in that? No, we're not. And people that are on the right wing of DSA who are, you know, very cynical, they acknowledge that and they're not wrong, but their solution is that we just accept that and say that's okay. And I think that's bullshit. That's not the way that we get anywhere. It's really just a way of attaching ourselves to someone else's project and hoping that we opportunistically pull some members, but as long as they do what we say, right? That's not going to work. That's not going to build the kind of organization we want or need. I think, you know, if you look at like, it should be pretty clear that like the question of what was the correct thing to do in the situation is not in question, right? Like nobody was like, well, Bowman should have voted for that billion. Like, you know, nobody says that, right? So like part of the debate that happened in DSA was trying to shift away from those, from what should have happened and bring up all these secondary questions. And we have to make sure that, you know, that we are setting clear terms of debate and saying, this is what we're talking about and not that stuff over there, right? Like don't get confused or don't let it get obfuscated. And the reason why is because holding firm on the question of Palestine here was in direct conflict with the like ambition to just be attached to elected officials. Because if you look at that letter, that poor unity letter, one like some of the most prominent signatories are elected officials in DSA. The signal that they were sending to DSA members was, we don't want Bowman disciplined because we don't want you to discipline us. We want to do whatever we want. We want free hands. And people were, you know, seeing that as a threat, right? And that absolutely did happen. So those people already had consciousness about their distinct role as DSA, quote unquote, politicians. It's us that were confused about that. And we're already playing catch up. I think that this is a real problem for DSA. It's really just a miracle that this didn't happen sooner, right? Like part of the reason why DSA tolerated stuff when AOC voted for like the border wall or something is because it was bound up in underfunding and people could make all kinds of secondary arguments. Well, she was voting for this and, you know, that's just how the sausage gets made. In this case, there was no way to avoid that question, right? It was a single line. It's just that. So, I think that's the real tension at work here. The problem with talking about process, and I'm somebody that talks about process all the time, is that people hate talking about process, right? It's the least interesting thing. Those process questions really only get developed in the course of actual political struggle and questions. So right now, right, like, you know, over the summer, I proposed that we have a referendum in DSA, and, you know, other people proposed having our platform be binding. Those things were seen as abstractions and nobody wanted to talk about them. And now they become real, right? That's where this stuff really starts to matter. And so I think that part of the bureaucratic organization of DSA is specifically to avoid the democratic whims of the organization, right? If you're in the leadership and your question is really like, how do you maintain this course of action, whether people like it or not, then you hide the information, you try to make the decisions behind closed doors so people don't know. And, you know, like that's how you pursue that. This last thing about form and leadership, I think, is really interesting. So this is kind of like a loose parallel between DSA and the question of the state in general, which is that you can't just change the leadership of an existing structure and expect everything to change with better leadership, right? Something about the way that organizations are structured really matters for the patterns of members, for their expectations, for the actual politics that happen, right? And you can't just stick in like a revolutionary left leadership in DSA, and you can't reform out the US state, right, with a different leadership. Something about the actual structure of the organization has to be different. And I think that, yes, we should talk about where we can collaborate in DSA, but a lot of this has to be about saying what is insufficient and wrong about the way that DSA has been structured, you know, in a Harringtonite period that we all inherited. And why is that not suitable for the type of organization that we need? The same, I think, can be said is that the Israeli state is an apartheid state. It cannot be changed so long as that's the way it is. It needs a fundamentally new state.
All right. Thank you, Andy. And Brandon and Andy will also have a chance to come in at the end with the wrap-ups. So definitely not the last that we were in between. We're going to take more open discussion. So again, if you want to come on Stack, directly message Stack here, and we'll try to get to as many people as we can here. It's pretty full already, but don't let that stop you. That said, though, do please try to keep your comments 2 to 3 minutes so we can fit in everybody who wants to speak. So we'll be starting off again here with Theo. Go ahead, Theo.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Quick response to Reform and Revolution speaker Brandon Madsen. Exposing socialists in name only, AOC and Rashida Tlaib through concrete demands like an educational town hall is a good idea. And DSA Marxists should have spoken in one voice to demand it. However, it is unreasonable to wait for BDS to pull favorably among American workers before expelling socialists in name only, Jamal Biden is trustworthy Bowman. American workers are already sick and tired of billions and trillions spent on endless wars, meddling, and imperial sprawl. The social base of the masses consciousness already exists to oppose Bowman on this basis. A mass consciousness formed through decades of anti-imperialist movements in the streets, in the unions, in academia, and in the culture industry. Trump is an expression of this already existing mass consciousness. Mass political education is absolutely needed, but it's certainly not needed to make a majority of Americans fluent in the details of the Israeli apartheid, BDS, and Palestine.
All right, thank you, Theo. Next up we have Alex, go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Alex, he, they pronouns from the Miami DSA chapter and Florida International University YDSA. So my comment slash question is sort of in agreement with many of the things that previous people asking questions have said. I'm somebody that very strongly supported, expelling Bowman, and I was very disappointed with the outcome of this. And I agree with what many people have been saying. Like, for example, I believe it was Noel that said that, you know, we shouldn't be using elected offices to sort of wheel and deal for power within the system, as opposed to, you know, using these offices as a means to build power for our organizations. I also believe, think that, you know, what Andy was saying earlier, about how national endorsed over, you know, the wishes of the local chapter was probably a mistake and an opportunistic endorsement. And, you know, I look towards people like, for example, the model that Shama Sawant and Socialist Alternative have in Seattle as sort of a maybe more productive example of holding elected officials accountable. And, you know, also just of other, you know, better local DSA officials. The question that I'm going to get to, the part that I'm going to get to, though, is with all of that being said, most of our elected officials, at the very least, like all of our federal elected officials, don't really fit that model of cadre candidates elected from the organization where DSA was the backbone of the campaign. A lot of them And a lot of the existing elected officials are sort of opportunistic endorsements. And, you know, in the words of Noel, wheelers and dealers, like, you know, we do have Bowman saying that, you know, Biden was a trustworthy negotiating partner, AOC calling Nancy Pelosi the mama bear of the Democratic Party in a positive sense. I'm finishing up soon. All of this, you know, to say, if, as somebody that supported expelling Bowman, if we actually succeeded, if we actually went through with it, what would that imply, or what would that mean then for the rest of the organization, or the rest of the elected officials who, you know, if we're being honest, if we were actually holding them to account, a lot of them, you know, wouldn't really be up to snuff, and a lot of them wouldn't really pass this test. So that's my question.
All right. Thank you, Alex. Next up, we've got Wallace.
Hello, everyone. Thank you. My name is Wallace. My pronouns are he, him, and I am from Portland, PSA, and I'm a member of Reform and Revolution. The point I wanted to bring up is that I agree with something Brandon said about working class majorities, and I think perhaps people have slightly misunderstood what was brought forward. I don't think Brandon is saying that socialists should wait for majorities of opinion to exist, but rather that the responsibility of the socialist movement is to work to develop majorities for our political opinions. And in fact, I think that the responsibility of the communist movement is to work towards developing a cohesive, organized, conscious working class movement that can resist imperialism and can fight for the liberation of the working class. To that end, I think that this conversation brings forward a more general point, which is that I believe it's essential for DSA to move towards more public-facing town halls and ideologically grounded discussions on these subjects. These debates could be either for educational or public observers. And I believe the importance of this is positioning DSA as a center of a lively, dynamic space for healthy, open debate. But it's also an opportunity for us to allow people to understand the critical questions of the working class movement. And I think getting our high profile leaders directly involved in these discussions is the way we can leverage the notoriety that has been gained through these, as some people have noted, somewhat opportunistic endorsements of people who are not cadre members of the organization, and take their presence, take their fame, and utilize it for the growth of a socialist movement that is more ideologically grounded in the principles of the communist movement. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Wallace. Next up, we have Philip.
Hi, everyone. Philip from Seattle DSA and Reform and Revolution. Really glad to have this discussion with everyone. You know, I think the discussion does is related to, you know, a larger debate in DSA about what's our relationship with the Democratic Party, and something that was debated at the last national convention of DSA, where I think there was a sort of a mood that we've had so much success for the previous 5 years, which DSA had so much success for the previous 5 years, we just keep doing the same thing and not taking into account change situations. So I think, you know, I think this whole debate shows I think it does matter. I don't think we can just it does matter to have elected officials in office, that you have a certain profile, but I think we want to use those elected positions to educate our class, to build consciousness. I think, you know, the issue that people bring up about this Bowman's vote, it definitely was an unpopular position, but I think we should have the expectation that as a representative of a socialist organization, we want Jamal Bowman and other elected representatives to vote in line with our politics, even if that's a minority view, and represent our politics. And I think part of that is building also an organization, a political organization that can actually really exert real pressure on our candidates through building up our own structures and a strong organization. Part of the discussion, I think, in DSA has to be, there's not enough clarity about what do we expect from elected representatives. And I think we do need to make a distinction between people who are members of DSA, who are running for office, represent DSA, and endorsements of non-DSA members. I think there's a fundamental different level of expectation. But we, part of our job is to build that consciousness in DSA that they need to vote and act in accordance with DSA's platform, that they will actively promote DSA in our campaigns, support our electoral campaigns, but also our non-electoral campaigns and try to urge people to join DSA. That means meeting regularly with the DSA leadership or its appointed representatives. So like in Congress, I think it makes sense to do that every, regularly every 3-4 months. And have a minimum thing, to form a socialist caucus in terms of, the 4 members in Congress to have their own socialist caucus rather than just being buried in the progressive caucus and sort of in the blob of the Democratic Party. And to have the expectation at minimum, if there's going to be votes where they're in out of line with the DSA platform, that they actively discuss and debate that with DSA, that they use their platform to promote DSA town halls to discuss that and debate that. I'm out of time, so I'll stop there.
All right, thank you, Philip. Next up, we have Tom M.
Hey, comrades. There's a lot of discussions about different principles, tactics, strategies, various political moments, but I'd like to just recenter the conversation to our internal problems. Some others have touched on this, and there's been a common thread throughout the conversation that we've actually been rebuked by our own leadership within DSA. There's a lack of structural mechanisms for discipline and transparency internally, not just between us and our electeds. Some people have alluded to the fact that resolutions have failed to pass at the 2021 National Convention, which according to my notes are resolutions 6 and 7. We failed in that political moment as an organization to pass something that would provide us the levers necessary to hold our own people accountable and then also extend that same accountability to electeds like Bowman. I know that everybody has various different theories and ideas on tactics and strategies, and I welcome these kind of conversations. I think the relative incoherence of the conversation just lends itself to the lack of space for these kinds of conversations. I personally would like to see a very short-term, measurable, actionable action on Tempest, R&R, and any other caucuses to use the Bowman affair as a lightning rod for internal restructuring of handling of these issues. Even as far as advocating for stricter disciplines, advocating for more transparency to the NPC, and rallying our own organization internally around how much of the debacle this entire situation was. I'm deeply disappointed in many political moments that have failed internally, and this one is probably the latest and most upsetting me. I cede my time. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Next up, we have John M. Go ahead, John.
Hi, everybody. John McLeod here from Seattle DSA, he, him pronouns. I was a couple minutes late, so I didn't hear the beginning, but I sure hope that this started off with some land acknowledgments. I haven't heard anybody made those yet. And there is something a little bit ironic about us discussing, withholding our support for an elected member of Congress because of his support for a settler colonialist project, and as we're all sitting here on stolen land. But I think I agreed with what the last speaker just said. I think we really need to clarify our position on our relationship with our elected officials. And I think it's really hard to answer this question without DSA having a very clear position on that issue. And as an earlier speaker, mentioned, if we want to start expelling people for not following DSA's platform, I don't think we would have anybody in Congress, because at some point, every one of the DSAers in Congress, has contradicted the platform. So I think what we need to do is just to me, this is more about, you know, process. And I think we need to have a very clear understanding of, you know, what exactly is a red line. Because, you know, I think that, you know, Bowman's position is absolutely heinous. And, you know, I think that one of the best parts of DSA is the fact that we can make our, you know, elected officials accountable to our platform, you know, like unlike the Democratic Party, which, you know, the platform doesn't really mean anything. You know, having said all that, you know, I, as a longtime socialist, I've always been a nonconformist, and there is something about, you know, like trying to like enforce ideological purity that like does make me a little bit uneasy. And I do want to bring up one example. You know, Bernie Sanders in the 90s, like his record on gun control was like really not that great. And, you know, you could say like, oh, well, that's just, that's a completely heinous position. Look at all the gun deaths in the United States. But on the other hand, I think Bernie like rightly knew that like his position on that issue is not going to change any of that, and like was not going to change the fact that if you want a gun in America, you can get one. And, you know, like that was like one of the only ways that he could continue, you know, winning elections in his like very rural, you know, district in Vermont. And, you know, thanks to that, we ended up, you know, later he was able to improve his record on gun rights. And, you know, he ended up, you know, being a very important catalyst for the socialist movement today. Now, I'm not trying to compare like the issue of gun rights to apartheid. But I just think that we need to have like a very clear stance on, you know, where exactly, what is a red line? And, you know, foreign policy is really messy. And I don't know, I just think that we need to have like a clear process and understanding of the, you know, relationship with our elected officials. And, you know, maybe we need to set up like some things that are red lines. And maybe in some cases, somebody should get their one issue that they can kind of disagree on. And as long as it's kept to one, like, you know, they're allowed to stay in DSA. You know, I don't know. Or maybe there needs to be like an intermediary thing between expelling and, you know, like maybe there needs to be some sort of censoring or something like that. You know, I don't know, but yeah, I see my time.
Thank you, John. Next up, we've got Eric. Go ahead, Eric. Or Eric S. in particular, if that helps.
Hey, sorry, I had to grab my hand out of my glove on the side. What I'm saying now, it's I jumped on Stack quite a while back. A number of people have already spoken to this, and I'd like to hear both Andy and Brandon both speak to the need for. Sorry, it's cold outside. Speak to a town hall meeting that we host, where we get Jamal Bowman to answer directly to questioning on what he's done. And I've heard a number of times in this meeting, folks pointing to the fact that DSA leadership has sort of made clear to its constituency that it's a reactionary force. And again, a thing I've heard mentioned in a number of ways is that this is a negative structural test, the crisis with Bowman. And I feel like in Andy's last segment, he spoke to a lot of the things that Brandon makes clear with his proposed town hall, is that a town hall meeting is one of the ways that we would build our structure to deal with leadership that is not in line with our principles. I'll see the rest of my time.
All right, thank you, Eric. And then lastly, we have Rami. Go ahead, Rami.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to respond to some points that Theo had raised. And by the way, I'm from Seattle DSA, he, him pronouns, and I'm also a member of the Reform Revolution Caucus. I think that if all that DSA could do was expel Bowman, we should do that. I'm agreeing with a statement Brandon mentioned earlier. Brandon said, if all DSA, if all we could pull off, if all we could muster is expelling Bowman for his votes to fund the Israeli military and so forth, we should expel him. But we're also saying that there's more that we could be doing as DSA to hold elected officials accountable. Like, why is Bowman voting this way? Why Bowman, who's a member of DSA and who's pretty left wing on economic issues and on the Green New Deal, he's voting in a right wing way on the Israeli issue. And I think the reason he's doing that is because a majority of his constituents in New York City have sympathies with what the state of Israel is doing. And so when Reform and Revolution members like Brandon have advocated that we have that DSA organize a town hall to invite Bowman, Rashida Tlaib, AOC, and other DSA elected officials it's to put more pressure on them for their position. It's to educate the public about what's going on in Palestine with the constant Israeli settlers taking more and more Palestinian land, the whole apartheid regime there. It's to educate DSA members on these issues, like, because there are some DSA members who think we should compromise on the Palestinian issue if that means maintaining our relationship with Bowman. And so the idea of having a big town hall would be to put more pressure on our elected officials from the left and by raising consciousness in the public, raising consciousness amongst DSA members that about what's really happening in Israel and Palestine, about the oppression of the Palestinians and how that's not acceptable and how our tax dollars shouldn't be going towards that, and exposing Bowman on that issue and raising consciousness around that issue. Because Bowman is voting that way right now because a majority of his constituents believe it's okay what is the state of Israel is doing to the Palestinians, and believe that somehow the state of Israel is protecting Jews from anti-Semitism. And I think we want to clarify those issues. It's a complex issue, Israel and Palestine. We want to explain we're against anti-Semitism, but we're also against the oppression of the Palestinians, and what the state of Israel is doing is absolutely oppressive of the Palestinians. And so, you know, if we can't get it together as DSA to organize town hall meetings like that in the future when our elected officials take terrible votes, then fine, then maybe all we can do is expel them. But I just think, and I would be supportive of expelling Bowman in this case, but I just want us as DSA members to grapple with the fact that if we just expel Bowman, it may not change his position. He may still keep voting the way we don't want him to vote because a lot of voters and people in the public and voters in his constituency think what the state of Israel is doing is okay. And so, you know, if we dissociate ourselves with him, which I'm open to doing that, I think it's probably a positive step. But if we just expel Bowman and DSA cuts off our ties with Bowman, it doesn't necessarily mean he's going to change his positions. And so if we could do things like organize town halls, big public town halls, hopefully get some media coverage, put some pressure on not only Bowman, but other progressive elected officials on these issues, that's a stronger way to hold them accountable, in, really stronger than just expelling them. I'm open to expelling them. I think it's a strong issue it's a red line he's crossed expelling. I would be open to doing that if that's all we could muster. But I think the idea of the town halls would be even stronger, possibly in addition to expelling. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Rami. With that wraps up our last open discussion section. We're running a little tad behind, so sorry for anybody who can't stay all the way through to the end, but we are going to have one last round with our panelists, 10 minutes for Andy, and then 10 minutes for Brandon to wrap up. So I know it's a lot to sum up, but what's the conclusion for DSA, you know, and for the socialist movement? Go ahead, Andy.
Well, first, thank you for inviting me. If I had known that, you know, I could have a coterie like spout my line, then I might have brought some people. I didn't realize the line today is town hall is the solution. So I've heard that a lot. I'm not against the town hall, like, whatever, sure. You know, like the thing that I wanted to point out was, okay, Bowman has had his opportunity to respond to DSA. He's, you know, there are existing structures that are there. So like, it's not as though none of the tools for dealing with this situation were available. There have been, and they were chosen not to be used. So we have two problems, right? One of them was that that Bowman had all of these opportunities. People used DSA's committees and tried to engage him. He was not interested, right? And at that point, then it was never made clear to members what was happening. And our duty as the left of DSA is to make that clear, right? Because no one else is going to do that. The reason why this became an issue is because we've forced it to be an issue. And I think that it gained so much purchase because all of this stuff was much more clear. And Bowman was clear. Bowman never had any interest in addressing the membership. He could have done that. The NPC could have asked him to. They spoke with him, right? Like, it could have been their opportunity to mediate and say, hey, we're going to do this thing. They just didn't want to have that happen. So, like, if we want to talk about town halls and stuff, that's cool. Let's do it. But you would have to be clear that DSA is not going to do that organizationally. That would have to be something that is done independently of DSA, like as a collaborative effort. Okay. Is Bowman going to show? No, I don't think he's going to show. He's already made his decision. And I have no confidence that the reason why he's taking his position is because he's just adhering to his constituency. I think that one, he's ideologically committed. Like, he's made it clear, this is where he stands. This is what he's going to do, right? He's spoken publicly about what his take is, right? So I don't think that it's sufficient to say that he's just responding to what he has to. I think that ends up being kind of a little too late here. Like, the issue is clear and now it's decision time. Like, if there was an opportunity to have a town hall, that would have probably been in early November, but now we're almost to February, right? Like, you know, he shouldn't be a continued member, right? Like, he's the line has been drawn. We don't have to wait for the NPC to draw that line. The membership clearly drew that line with the repeated calls for expulsion. So this is not like we invented something out of whole cloth, right? A lot of people felt this widely and deeply. And now sort of we get to choose how we respond to that. And I don't think that we are served by trying to be like adults in the room or something right now. Like, this is where it is. There's a whole bunch of secondary things that show up here. Like, I want to say that, like, this has been a very interesting discussion. It's demonstrated a lot of where people stand on stuff. And I think that's really helpful. Conversations like this are messy when it's the first time we've had them. And so that does demonstrate that we need to have continued dialogue, right? Like, things will come clearer as we bring them up. People are working out ideas, and that's all positive. But this idea about ideological purity, I think, is also missing the point, where it's like, what do you stand for as an organization? Like, would we tolerate somebody that was an open white supremacist? I don't think so, right? Like, there are lines that matter. We are defining ourselves in opposition to some things as socialists. One of those things is capitalism. Another one of those things is imperialism. We have to draw those lines sometimes. And a big tent is not an open field. It means that there are bounds of the tent. Some things can't be in the tent. So what else could I say? What would it have meant to expel Bowman? I think what it would have meant is that DSA has expectations of its elected officials. Would that mean that we would expel every single person for crossing every line? No, I don't think so at all, right? I don't think that's what it would have meant, but I think it would have established a precedence where we say, if you cross certain things, that there will be consequences, that you should think about what your relationship to this organization is, and we are serious about it. So you should be serious too. And maybe people aren't clear about what the purpose of a socialist elected is, but I don't think that the purpose of it is to negotiate a series of, you know, small tinkerings of deals and do real politic. Like, that doesn't serve us in anything. I think that they have to basically use the opportunity and the influence that they have by being in that position to agitate for socialist politics, to show where things are happening, to help, aid in the organization and combativity of our class, But if they are consistently legitimizing the existing regime and saying that something like Biden is excellent and, you know, he's a great guy and we should put our faith in him, that's undermining our interests as a socialist, right? I think that, you know, we really do have to have a sense about, you know, the elected officials as being kind of tribunes of our class, as people that are going to put out the clearest idea of those politics. And sometimes, yeah, they will be in the minority. Yes, absolutely, we want them to be in the majority, but we don't arrive at a majority by you know, softening our message and by compromising routinely. I think that most American workers are sick of that, right? Part of the reason why people hate politicians is because they stand for nothing, right? We want people that are clear about who our class enemies are and have a sense about what we're going to do about that. So in DSA, you know, for one, I think we have to really fight for this concept of what our elected officials are and what the purpose of them is, that they have to be like our people that are broadcasting our message as far as possible and helping to build our class forces. And, you know, like, what do we do to achieve the changes within DSA? You know, to me, this is a really difficult question. I don't have a singular answer. Should the forces of the left of DSA, whoever that is, work together? Yeah, we should. But the question is on what, right? Like, if we say right now that we're just going to get the gang together and hang out, like, you know, what does that do? Like, for one, we're geographically distributed, so that's going to be practiced on a local level first. But second is going to be, there has to be an actionable thing for us to relate to. And that's where we're going to test out how we can build this broader front. So I'm all for saying, like, let's say, do we have a common vision and how can we, you know, make that as appealing as possible to the most people in DSA? Absolutely must happen. We should do that. And we should begin that work soon. But I think it would be a mistake to say that we just raise the banner and everybody will come to us. You know, secondarily, we have to have a common sense of what our objectives are in DSA. I don't know that everybody is completely clear on that. I think that the jury is kind of out right now on whether DSA is going to be the form that a socialist organization that we need takes. I am in DSA. I believe in being in DSA for a reason. I've heard Steve Lee say the same thing at every meeting I've ever been to with him. But, you know, you have to kind of go where people are and relate to them and be part of the experience that we're having. And, you know, we're going to grow in shape together. And whether revolutionaries are there and present and relating and being able to explain what's happening, it is an important task to be done. There, you know, opportunism is not something that is just like a poison that you can just, you know, completely free yourself of. There are reasons why there are opportunistic tendencies in organizations. Some of those are material, and have to do with the pressures of the capitalist state as it is. So, like, elected officials are always going to face this issue where what matters more, the base of people that they're ideologically committed to or all the other incentives that they get. That's not something we're going to easily solve with the system as it is. And I think also, if there are no opportunistic kind of temptations, then all that means is we're completely isolated. Like, we're going to have to learn how to deal with opportunism. And I'm not saying to coexist with it. I'm saying that, like, that we're going to have to be able to deal with existing things that will happen in the development of our movement. So I completely celebrate, you know, the comrades from R&R for putting this together. I very much appreciate it. And I look forward to more collaboration. I'm really interested in hearing kind of how other people are relating to these questions. I think that DSA is not a sunken ship here and people shouldn't flee, right? There are some people that are looking for every opportunity to say that DSA is awful. Well, you know, sorry, like, if you're looking for that, you're going to find every reason, but you have to also look for reasons to be around people. And there is a lot of important work. So thank you very much.
And thank you, Andy. All right. And then we'll turn to Brandon to wrap us up. Go ahead, Brandon.
Yeah, thanks. I think this has been really great. And I want to just
start by thanking Andy for being here and for all the people who have made contributions to the discussions. I think we get a lot out of that interplay. And I really agree with what Andy said about how, like, yeah, it's messy when you try and have a discussion and it's like the first time you've ever had this sort of, you know, synchronous discussion about this thing. Like, so much of this has played out unofficially in the margins via, yeah, the internet, not just the internet, but Twitter, Facebook, whatever. Obviously this is also the internet, but at least we're able to have a real-time dialogue. And I think the fact that we haven't had that in any official capacity still on this question is, anyway, I think that is a shame. So just to first start by responding to a few things, I think, you know, Andy at one point said that we're not going to get all the things that I was outlining that we should have if the Israeli state stays intact, that the apartheid state is sort of built into its DNA, and so we're not going to get those things. I agree. I don't think we're going to reform our way within the Israeli state to get all those things I outlined. I think workers need to overthrow the state and take power into their own hands. In general, think that. I don't have any belief that the parameters that I talked about this democracy and all of that is going to be meaningfully achieved within the current capitalist state. So I think, just to be explicit about that, that's what I think is going to be necessary. But I think in terms of how do you build the movement that is capable of fighting for and winning that revolution, I think that's where the politics of what we're calling for come in. Not because we utopianly think that, you know, that it's going to transform the situation within the existing state, but because those are the politics I think are a strong foundation for trying to get people on board with trying to build a majority for, build working class power around over time. So similarly, I think on the idea that we can't wait for a working class majority support before we expel Bowman for his position, I agree with that too. Yeah, I think that it's not about waiting for a majority of support, but it's still about trying to win it. You still have to take what actions you can with what forces you have at all times. There's no getting around that or any excuse for waiting. But I think there's also not an excuse for sort of leaving aside the part where you're still trying to more people in and build your forces stronger so you can do even more. I'm for expelling Bowman on the basis of this position, I think. But expulsions are not enough is the sort of slow. If I have a take or a slogan, that's sort of the line for me is expulsions are not enough. That I think it's correct and good to do that with the position that he has. But I think it would be much stronger if it were the culmination of a whole democratic process, a process that unfortunately was never organized. And that in the end, it's going to take a much stronger apparatus than just a willingness to do expulsions that's going to hold electeds accountable. I think it's primarily a political question of building the political foundation within DSA for that. And so I think we need to use these discussions as opportunities to educate DSA members and the public about our positions, that we have to be striving to lay that foundation and build that majority throughout everything that we're doing. I also think that, you know, people have brought up the question of the Democratic Party. Some of this has been in the chat, but I think we need a break from the Democratic Party. I do. I think that we need to be building towards that. But like all these other things that I've laid out, you know, it's one thing to have that in your program to say, like, yes, I support a viable third party with left politics, working class base. You know, you can call that, but in order to make that a reality, to make that viable party a reality, is a process that and a battle that we have to fight and win. It's not something you can just sort of declare is what you want and then it happens. And so I think in everything that we say, including when we run people, DSA runs candidates, I think they should be openly saying, you know, we are trying to lay the basis for a break with the Democratic Party and should call out the Democratic Party as an imperialist party. And I think they should do that even if they're running as Democrats. not, I think, you know, it's a tactical question in my mind, whether you run on the Democratic Party line or not. I think we should look for as many opportunities to you know, run independently of the Democrats as possible. But I think even when we're running within them, okay, that's a tactical discussion, but then you still have to be politically clear of where you stand. And to me, politically, the clear answer is that the Democrats are an imperialist party inherently, a capitalist party inherently, and that we're trying to break with that and lay the basis for a party of working people. And so I think that, anyway, I think that's something that obviously I haven't had enough chance to get into in the discussion so far, and it might be weird to be just bringing it up at the end. Anyway, I think that's something that we need to be taking into account. We need to break our class, the working class, labor movement, social movements, organizations away from the Democratic Party. But I think the primary way we're going to do that is not by simply admonishing people, don't vote for the Democrats or whatever. I think that's actually the less important side of it. It's not the negative, the refraining from voting for the Democrats. That won't do very much, I don't think. I think the main thing is building an alternative to the Democrats. And so I would much rather have more people actively vote for an alternative to the Democrats, even while they're still voting for Democrats in other races. I would much rather have that than just break those people away from the Democrats where they don't vote Democrat, but they don't build an alternative either. Anyway, that's my take on that. I think that I just want to emphasize that I think we do need to organize a Marxist wing in DSA, and hopefully these types of discussions are, you know, help lay the foundations for cohering a Marxist wing in DSA that can put forward some of these things and can be more prepared to speak with a more unified voice if we can find consensus on issues in the future, to work actively in that direction towards accountability measures, towards a break with the Democrats, towards rounding out a genuinely socialist program that includes a rupture from capitalism, as opposed to the lack of that that's in the current DSA program. But I do think it's important that we do that with, I think, in DSA and more or less in or out of DSA isn't the main question, but I think that people who are talking about leaving DSA as if that's going to solve the problem, I think that is mistaken. I think that if the Marxists and revolutionaries like decide, okay, we're going to leave DSA and set up our own project on the side, there's a certain case for that. But even then, I think there would have to be a strong orientation toward DSA, that we can't just ignore it. We would have to still try, and it's still the biggest socialist organization in the country, and you need to, it is the center point of the socialist movement. And so we can't, while taking our task seriously, ignore the task of trying to win DSA to our positions. And so in or out, we're still gonna have to deal with these problems and these political shortcomings and try and help improve them. And so I think it's easier to do that from within. Some people might think it's easier from without, but I think either way, DSA has to be a clear orientation here. And I also think that the problems that DSA faces, these are not specific problems to the structures and history uniquely of DSA, in my view. I think the problems faced by DSA are the problems any comparably sized socialist organization at this moment would face, and that they are the problems of the socialist movement in the US in general right now. And so there's no shortcut to confronting those problems and working through those problems. We're going to have to do it wherever we are, sooner or later. If we try and get around it, we're just delaying the inevitable in that respect. And so, I see some stuff in the chat about the dirty break. So just to respond in real time, I think, yeah, I think you could describe what I stand for as a dirty break. But I think the key question, the fundamental part of that, is the break. I'm for taking a break seriously. And so I do think that, you know, the most effective strategy towards getting there is to you know, put the focus on building for an alternative rather than putting the focus on stopping voting for Democrats altogether. But either way, I think the much more important piece to emphasize is we do need to build an alternative that's viable. And so I think that is bound up with all the other issues that we've been talking about. And that's going to be key to how we hold candidates accountable as well, is by building a party or party-like, and in the meantime, party-like structure that has a definite program that we can hold people to, and that is widely discussed and known and arrived at democratically through the structures of DSA. So I'm at time and I'll stop there.
All right, thank you so much, Brandon. And thank you everyone for your contributions to the discussion, and a big thank you to Andy for taking the time to prepare and be here today to talk about this important issue. It's really great to have you as well. And if you're interested, if you're interested in the Tempus Collective, you can visit their website and check out their publications at www.tempusmag.org. It was dropped in the chat, but kind of got buried with everything else. So just want to call attention to that. And again, of course, just want to remind everyone, if you're interested in Reform and Revolution, please do check out our magazine and subscribe so you can get our new issue coming out early February. And at the link shared in the chat on our website, you can also see full PDFs of our previous issues if you're interested for free. Finally, please fill out the form that's going to be shared in the chat. You can give feedback about the meeting today and then stay in the loop for upcoming meetings. This is one of several public Zoom meetings we'll be organizing this year to address critical issues facing DSA and the wider left. So keep an eye out for when the next one gets announced. And again, thank you everyone for coming, and I hope you all have a good rest of your Sunday. Take care, all.